Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, last week I made a mistake. The mistake was last week I gave a shiur explaining whether a person's allowed to or not allowed to switch their right of davening. If I daven Nusach Ashkenaz, can I switch to Nusach Sfar? If I daven Nusach Sfar, can I switch to Nusach Ashkenaz? And we gave a shiur about that. I don't think any of the halachic statements made last week were wrong, but what was wrong is that I didn't explain how the heck, pardon the expression, like heck is a very bad word, but how did we get these different Nuska'ot HaTfilah? How did we come to a place that there are different rites of prayer? After all, right, they told us in grade school that, and this is a Gemara, right? It's a Gemara in Brachos Daf Lamed Gimel. It's like the fourth source that we have on the sheet, right? The Gemara says, Amalei Rav Shemen Ba'abal Rabbi Yochanan Michtei An Sheik Neset HaGedola Tiknu Lahem LeYisrael Brachos Tfilos Kedushos Havdalos. Right? Then the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah instituted all these things. They instituted that we should say brachos. They instituted davening. They instituted kedusha. They instituted havdalah. And the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, we know what this body was. This is a body that began basically at the end of the first temple period. Right? And it continued until Shimon HaTzadik, the Mishnah says, which is, let's say, the year 250 BCE. Right, so Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Gemara says, instituted davening. So, I don't understand. If the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah instituted davening, so let's see what they said. Did the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah say Morid Hatal, or did they not say Morid Hatal? Did the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, like, see what they said? Why is it so difficult? How come I have all of these different texts and rites of tefillah, when ultimately it's supposed to come from the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah? And the Gemara asks a question in the context of Havdalah. We should figure out, did they say Havdalah is part of davening? Was Havdalah a separate prayer, etc.? That's why the Gemara says it. But for us, the question is more fundamental. How on earth do we have different rites of davening? That's the question we have to figure out tonight. So far, so good? Was anyone ever bothered by this question before? Like, how could you have Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Sfard? How come Hasidim are so funny looking? Anyone bothered by this question? Oh, sorry.
I don't have a problem, but the question that I was going to raise, I guess since you opened up, I'll jump right in terms of
the pronunciation.
Yeah.
So I thought I would talk about pronunciation tonight. Then I changed my mind. If you want, we could talk about that very, very briefly. There were two schools of dikduk way back when. There was a school of Ben Naphtali and a school of Ben Asher. And these two schools are reflected, the Minchat Shai, which is like a classic work on dikduk, often points out that there are huge differences between these two schools. And these differences impacted also on pronunciation. Sfaradit has only five vowels. No? They pronounce a kamat and a patach the same. They pronounce a cholam, right? The same as a kamat katan, effectively. They pronounce a tsere, right? The same as a segol. Right? Now, technically speaking, they perhaps should distinguish that a kamat is slightly longer than a patach, but practically speaking, they pronounce it the same. The other school pronounced the vowels differently, and traditionally Ashkenazis has a komat and a patach, or an a, right? Sfaradit has only one. Now,
on certain words,
well, Sfaradit should technically not distinguish between kamatz and patach. There is a kamatz katan, which is more like an o for Sfaradit also, because a kamatz katan is related to a cholam, to an o. But be it as it may, Sfaradit only has basically five vowels, Ashkenazis has ten. There's also differences in terms of, do you distinguish between the beged kefet with a dagesh and without a dagesh? Right? We learned in grammar in grade school that beged kefet berosh milah, if you have a bet, gimel, dalet, kaf, pei, tuf at the beginning of the word, or at the beginning of a syllable, it goes from being rafe to being dagush. Right? So a fe becomes a pei. No? In most cases, beged kefet, the only exceptions are if it's samuch la'ahavi. If you have a beged kefet that comes after an aleph, hey, vav, or yud, then it's going to be rafe. Al kein kar'u la'yamim ha'ele furim. Why is it not purim? Why is it furim? Right? Why is it the letter fe? You know, Sesame Street is brought to us today by the letter fe. It's our favorite letter. How come it's furim, not purim? It's karu layamim ha'ele. It ends with a he, so it's beged kefet that is samach to a he, in which case it is rafe. Now, Sfaradit, generally speaking, in Sfaradit, they would distinguish, in traditional Sfaradit, they would distinguish between all of the sounds when they had a dagesh or not. And in the Yemenite tradition, a gimel with a dagesh is a ja, without a dagesh is a g. No? A dalet is a the versus a duh. Things like this. Over time, and because of difficulties in pronunciation, so they stopped distinguishing between the gimels and the dalets. And they stopped distinguishing between the suf and the tuf also. That's what happened. Ashkenazis, for some reason, maintains a distinction between suf and tuf, even though there is no distinction between the gimel and the jimel, and the dal and the valid. Right? That is just the way it developed. Now, the question as to whether you're allowed to change your havara. I grew up, my early childhood, we lived in Baltimore, then we moved to West Orange. When we lived in West Orange, so I went to a school that was then called the Hebrew Youth Academy, West Caldwell, New Jersey, which subsequently got money from a man named Kushner and became the Kushner Academy. But I went there when it was still the Hebrew Youth Academy. In fact, I was there when the school moved from being like a little schoolhouse in then East Orange, it moved to Caldwell, and it bought an old Dutch boy paint factory, and I was like so proud of myself since my father was like running the Federation, and so I saw a Dutch boy paint factory when there's still a Dutch boy paint factory before they made it into the school. So I was like so amazing, because like, I like saw. So in Hebrew Youth Academy as a kid, they taught us how to read Hebrew in Sfaradit. Right? And then later on, when we moved to Lawrence and we were orbiting in more yeshivish circles, I was the only kid speaking in Sfaradit. And I used to lean in shul in Sfaradit. And Rabbi Wurzburger, Zechron Olif Rach, I was the only one who used to lean in Sfaradit. He's like, fine, no problem, he didn't care. But I used to lean in Sfaradit. And I was like a fairly regular Baal Kriya. I would lean when I was 13, 14, regularly in Sfaradit. Then at some point I decided that I didn't like Sfaradit anymore. No one was speaking Sfaradit, so I was going to switch to Ashkenazis. Now, mind you, Sfaradit was something that my father was very into, because my grandfather had made Aliyah, and my grandfather decided to become a bit of a Sfaradi when he made Aliyah. My grandfather was speaking in Sfaradit back in Montreal. He had a Hebrew-speaking home, and he was speaking in Sfaradit, and he was very into davening in Sfaradit, speaking in Sfaradit. My father was not happy with me when I switched to Ashkenazis at that time. And the question is, as a matter of halacha, was I allowed to switch or not allowed to switch? I grew up in Sfaradit. Now, of course, my family tradition probably was speaking Ashkenazis, but we took on Sfaradit because my grandfather had this Zionist urge to take on Sfaradit. And my father was speaking Sfaradit, but then I was speaking Sfaradit, but then I switched back to Ashkenazis. Then at some point in life when I was in Karen B'Yavna in Israel, I really went nuts because everyone around me was in Sfaradit, and then I'm really like pulling out my hair because I switched back. There was like a few months I was like leaning in shul and I was awful because I was like leaning in Ashkesfarad. Like half of the things Ashkenaz said, it was really big. Now, it happens that Rav Ben Sion Chai Uziel has a tshuva that he writes that you're allowed to switch from Ashkenazis to Sfaradit based on the fact that one of the Rebbeim of the Chasam Sofer, Reb Nosson Adler, according to tradition, hired a Rebbe from Yemen to teach him correct pronunciation of Hebrew. He was convinced that the Taimani Hebrew pronunciation was more correct than the standard Ashkenazi Hebrew pronunciation, and Reb Nosson Adler changed his pronunciation. Now, the Chassam Sofer himself says, yeah, that was my Rebbe, he was a big tzaddik, don't learn from him. Like, you know, don't do it like that. That's basically what the Chassam Sofer says. But Rebbe Tzion Chai Uzi al Paskin says Sfardit is more correct, and you can change to Sfardit. What's fascinating over here is that Rav Kook wrote a Haskama to Rav Ben Tzion Chai Uziel's tshuvas, and this is like the least haskama of any haskama you've ever seen. That right, he basically, the haskama, he attacks two tshuvas of Rav Uziel. This is his haskama. Right? First, Rav Uziel had a kula to allow milking of the cows on Shabbos through Jews, even though technically it says in Shulchan Aruch only a non-Jew should milk the cows. Rav Uziel had a complicated kula to allow Jews to milk the cows, and Rav Kook says, no, that's dead wrong. And then about Rav Uziel's tshuva about switching from Ashkenazis to Sfardit, Rav Kook, big Zionist Rav Kook, writes, Al titosh toirasimecha, meaning, keep the tradition. Keep your mother's tradition. Don't change. Now, part of the issue also comes up that if you want to change because you're going back to something that is more correct, that's good in theory, but you better be pretty darn sure that what you're switching to is necessarily correct. All of the scholars note that, you know what, Ashkenazic Hebrew is corrupted. Sephardic Hebrew is also corrupted. Certainly the standard Hebrew that I was taught in Hebrew Youth Academy, right, is neither Ashkenazic nor true Sephardic. If you want to switch to be like Reb Nosson Adler, to learn Yemenite pronunciation, which has a tradition going back, 2,000 years? Okay, that's one thing. But today's standard modern Israeli Hebrew is what we say nishtahin and nishtaher. Right? It's somewhere in between.
What happened to Roy is a phenomenon that the Israeli boys would say ow, and the boys would go off.
And they would learn oi.
So it's Ashkenazis, but it's...
But that's giving up on their tradition. It happens that the ow is probably a more correct way of vocalizing the chaulam, because the Rishonim who wrote on Dikduk will speak about that each vowel has a hidden letter that is not written in the word but is pronounced. Now, what is the hidden letter of the chaulam? So they speak about how the hidden letter of a chaulam is an aleph. If you are saying ois, the hidden letter is a yud, not an aleph. So the ow or the o is probably more correct. The ow might be more correct than the o for a whole host of reasons. But the fact is, if you're going to be switching your havara, you have to switch to something that's absolutely correct. That's the only heter to switch, is that, okay, I know what I'm doing is wrong. But we really don't know what correct Hebrew sounds like. We don't know. And as such, switching is problematic. However, then the question comes up, like what I did as a kid. I switched from Sfardit, which wasn't my authentic practice, back to Ashkenazis. Am I supposed to do that or not? That's a machlokas haposkim. If Moshe Feinstein would say that you should go back to Ashkenazis, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach basically says, once you've been trained one way, he says, keep it. Right? He would say that I should have maintained my Sfardit that I learned in, whatever, in grade school, yeah?
Don't we have clues in Hebrew poetry? I mean, from that, Begat al Tagidu. If it's Begat al Tagidu, then the consonants falls apart.
I mean, there are proofs like this. There are proofs from Piyut. But there is also contradictory evidence about these points. This requires much more time and knowledge than they have, so I don't know if we'll go here. But the fact is, that conversation, which I originally thought we'd talk about and decided not to talk about it, then Mr. Reeser decided I should talk about, so we spoke about it. Okay? So now, No problem. Let's just review what we're up to. The question is, how did we get the Siddur the way we have it today? Right? Or the various Sidurim the way we have them? How on earth did this happen? After all, Anshei Knesset HaGedola instituted prayers, and presumably they instituted a fixed prayer. So just figure it out. Go back and figure it out. So the answer is,
as you go through history, certain things have been added, like Lama Shirin.
Right, so as you go through history, some things have been added, certainly, like, but let's go back to the stuff that wasn't added and figure out the correct text of that. Right? In other words, I know that they said a bracha called Avos, right? Magen Avraham. So why don't I look at their text and figure out what it is? So what's the answer? I have no idea what their real text was, A, based on reasons that we'll discuss. B, I don't know if Anshei Knesset HaGedola instituted a text of prayer. Okay, this is going to be radical. But Anshei Knesset HaGedola instituted formulas of prayer. The formula of prayer is, let's say, Shmona Esrei, which is now 19 brachot. Right? But Shmona Esrei, they told us which bracha follows which. They give us the order. But they also have certain rules that they instituted about which brachot are long brachot in terms of beginning with Baruch, ending with Baruch, which are short brachot. But they did not tell me a specific text for the bracha of Rifa'inu. And presumably the way davening used to work way back when was that you had a chazan who was expert on the rules that Anshei Knesset HaGedola set up, which bracha follows which, etc. And the chazan would get up, and the chazan also, you know, he liked his voice and he liked his poetic ability. And the chazan would add and he would change. And if he was in the mood, you know, like you ever heard of Sfaradi Kaddish? Like goes on and on and on and on. And if he's in the mood, if he's in the mood, he would add 20 different adjectives. If he's in less of a mood, he would shorten it. Sometimes a little bit of this, sometimes a little bit of that. So now, prayer was standardized in terms of the rules, but it was not standardized in terms of the exact text.
But you get deviations from the Baruch Shama comes before Hodu. That's
not
text, that's order.
So Baruch Shama comes before Hodu is a deviation within Psukei Dezimra. Whether Psukei Dezimra is Talmudic or post-Talmudic, we could probably give another shir about a different time. Let's assume it was Talmudic. Baruch She'amar is not found in the Talmud, however. Yishtabach is not found in the Talmud. Psukei Dezimra is in the Talmud, but the Brachos on Psukei Dezimra is not. Now, whether the Hodu is before or after, yes, there are different minhagim. How did this happen? My guess would be that Anshei Knesset HaGedola said that you should say Psukei Dezimra, and they didn't tell me exactly what. And there is room for variance. No? Now, this is not Schwartz's Chiddush. This is a Rambam. Right? The Rambam tells us, interestingly, first let's just go very quickly. Source 1, just to prove that Tefillah evolves. Right? So the Mishnah in Tumid is probably the earliest source of davening. This is one of the only Tefillahs we know from the first temple period. Most tefillah that we have is Anshei Knesset HaGedola, which is between the temples extending into the second temple period. What did we have in first temple period? This is the earliest source. Amalahem Aham Nuna, Birchu Brach Achas, Ahim Birchu Kara Sarba Teves, Kara Sarba Esar Sadvarim, excuse me, I'm tired. Shema Vayomer, Birchu Esa'am, Shalosh Brachot, Amet Yasev Avodah, Birchat Kohanim, Shab Mosim Brachachat, Lemishma Yotzei. The Memuna is the designated Kohen, would tell the people, make a bracha, and they would make a bracha. And then he said, read Aseret HaDibrot, and they did that. And they said, Shema B'Hayam Shemoa. So in the earliest text of formal prayer that we have, it includes Aseret HaDibrot. Does anyone here say Aseret HaDibrot every day? Wouldn't it make sense to say Esther Hadibros every day? Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille, like whatever. It makes perfect sense.
They stopped doing that.
What?
No, they stopped doing it because they didn't want people, and it was sort of a Christian.
Says the Gemara.
The essence is the Ten Commandments, and you can forget.
Says the Gemara that originally they wanted to say Aseres Hadibros and davening every day, but they got rid of it because of Tarumas Haminim. Because Minim, by the way, is a technical term for early Christians. The early Christians were in the business of knocking down the number of commandments. No?
No.
And therefore, if we're going to say Aseres Hadibros as part of the liturgy every day, they're going to say, whoa, whoa, all you guys got is Aseres Hadibros, forget it. Right? And all that matters is Aseres Hadibros. So to avoid that, what they decided was, you know what, we're not saying Aseres Hadibros. That's what the Gemara says. Now, that's interesting, because that means, pardon, that there is an evolution of prayer. If in the earliest source I have Aseres Hadibros as part of davening, then for a very valid, good, wonderful, absolutely amazing, marvelous reason, they decided not to say Aseres Hadibros in davening every day. That means that prayer evolves.
If prayer evolved, then why are people so upset that some people do away with
what they're So, I actually took out from the library today Professor Sperber's book on evolution in prayer, and that's exactly the theme of his book. Now, I'll say it like this. We know that prayer evolves, but we also know that the evolution of prayer that we accepted was always... I don't know if we know, but there are many who surmise that the evolution that took place was a top-down type of evolution that was inspired by the Gedolim who made decisions. Now, let me read for you. In Professor Sperber's book, he sets up a straw man called Rabbi Soloveitchik.
What's the title of that?
Oh, I don't know. I should have brought it, I'm sorry. So Professor Sperber, in his book, I think this book came out in 2007. It's based on lectures he gave in Jofa about this issue of Shalos Ani Isha. He quotes Rav Soloveitchik as follows. Using fixed forms, I admit my unworthiness. Meaning, by saying the same text, I'm paraphrasing obviously, by saying the same text that everyone until me said, I admit that I am completely unworthy. I don't deserve to daven. I am only praying because my ancestors prayed. Rav Soloveitchik was very into the idea that you need a matir to daven. That effectively, it is presumptuous for finite man to try to approach the divine. We should be incapable of doing so. The only heter I have to do it is because my ancestors, who were so great, did this also. Now, if that's the case, that I'm really incapable of davening, and I'm only doing it like riding on the shoulders of giants, so I better stay very, 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 very close to what they instituted. Because if I deviate a tiny bit, then I don't have my heter to pray at all. Because think about it, who am I? I'm a busser for Dhamma, I'm an ordinary... Who am I to approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu? I don't have the right. Ein lavo shar hamelech. How are you going to get in? The answer is I'm only getting in through the fixed prayer. Now, part of the question of instituting new prayers and tampering with it relates to this issue that we're discussing tonight, but part of it also relates to just how accessible we assume God is and how much God wants our own initiative in davening. Everyone holds that I'm allowed to add in the middle of my private Shmona Esrei as much as I want. But what we're talking about is adding to the fixed prayers, to the communal prayers. If you, in the shul down the block, go in and you say Nusach Sfarad Kaddish with V'yatzmach Porkani V'kariv Mashiachai, you will be stoned with a piece of Aufschnitt. Guaranteed, right? Is that a fair assessment? Now, That's because they are very careful about their minhagim. And that is wonderful. That's amazing. And that's why their minhagim are carried over from generation to generation. Places where they are less careful about the minhagim are more open to change. Right? The Chassam Sofer's whole approach of any change, any deviation is asur, that is also coming from the fact that the Chassam Sofer was culturally a Yakka. Right? He's an Oberlander. That's Pressburg, right? This is part of an attitude toward life. Again, it's also halachic reasoning, and it's also polemic, but it's part of an attitude toward life. So now, there is evolution in tefillah. You can't deny it. Our question is how this happened. I should also add an important point over here. Let's just look at the bottom two sources, and then we'll largely talk. Tonight will be less source-based than usual. The Gemara in Shabbos, Kuf Tes Vav, says, the Gemara speaks about what am I allowed to say when there's a fire on Shabbos. The Gemara says, Habrachos ha-kameyin, ahav yishiyish ben osi yosho shem, u-minyanos harbe shabbatore, e-masyanos ha-matnei ha-deleka, el-nisrafim bim-koman. If you have an amulet, and it's in the building where there's a fire on Shabbos, you're not allowed to save the amulet. Why? Mikan amru kotvei brachot kesarfei Torah. If you write brachos down, you're like burning Torah. In other words, you're not supposed to write brachos down at all. That's a very important line, Gemara. That goes back to what we were saying before. I'm not supposed to write down the text of tefillah. Devarim she ba'al peh e'at ha-rashay l'kosvam applied to davening. And as such, the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah did not institute a specific text of prayer. What they instituted, again, and the Rambam has this in Perek Aleph of Tefillah, Halacha Aleph Beis Gimel Dalet. Maybe we'll read Halacha Dalet in more detail in a few moments. But they instituted a sequence, they instituted rules, but they didn't legislate exactly which word is which. Now, the Rambam tells me in a different place, in the Perish HaMishnah in Menachos, the Rambam writes that the reason why Anshei Knesset HaGedolah never instituted a formal order of exactly which words of prayer, the Rambam says, Kishem shol kava seder hatfila kolom anusacha v'seder minui shaleach tzibar machmas persumo shol davar lefi shalo chiber sidur ela chiber sefer dinim. Right? What the Rambam basically is saying is that those things that everybody knows, you didn't have to write down. Everybody knew how to daven. Everybody knew exactly what words to say, so there's no need to write it down. It's a little bit the opposite. Right? The first approach is saying, don't write it down, we want a certain freedom to roam. The second approach is saying, no, everybody knows exactly what to do. But be it as it may, it wasn't written. Now, let's learn another Rambam, and then we'll talk for a few moments. Rambam Perek Aleph Halacha Dalet. Originally, the Rambam says davening was d'oraisa, but there's no formula for davening. People would just daven on their own, just shevach b'kosh avada, whenever you want. Kevan shegolo Yisrael b'meinu v'chanetzah harasha. Once there is exile, nis'arvu b'paras v'yavan nish'ar ha'umos. So they get mixed up in different countries, and they have children in those nations, and those children nispal b'lus v'asam. Those children didn't speak Hebrew clearly. Their Hebrew was mixed up with many other languages. They spoke a mixture of Hebrew and Yiddish. Of course, no other language says Yiddish. And when they would speak, they couldn't speak. It's like a yeshiva bacher, right? Rav Huttner used to comment that yeshiva guys are amazing because they are illiterate in three different languages. Now, the Rambam is saying that. Right? Whenever they would speak, they couldn't speak properly in any one language. They'd only make mistakes. Right? And he quotes a pasuk, "Ve'einam makirim l'daber Yehudit," and they didn't know how to speak Hebrew properly. Ukelashonam va'am u'mipneizek shaya echad hen mihaleo tikatzer l'shano lishol chafatzav ola hagid shemach hakadosh baruch hu b'loshon hakodesh achi arvu ima l'shono sachiros. What happened was when they would daven, they couldn't speak in proper Hebrew, and people would truncate their tefillos. They would daven shorter, and they'd mix in other languages. When Ezra and his Bezdin saw that, that's what we call Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, so they instituted 18 brachos al haseder. The first three are praise for God, the last three are thanking, the middle, we ask for whatever we need. Why? Kidei sheyu aruchos b'fi hakol, vilamdu otan, v'tiyat tefilas eila halagim tefilas shleima, ketefilat balei halashon hatzacha. The reason why Anshe Knesset HaGedolah instituted tefilas, says the Rambam, is so that the people who don't speak Hebrew well should also have a good, clean text to say. That's what the Rambam is saying, no? So, the difficulty with this Rambam is it's a bit of a contradiction to the other Rambam, no? This Rambam is saying that the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah instituted tefillah so that everyone says exactly the same thing. The way we said Anshe Knesset HaGedolah earlier, they didn't really institute exactly the same. Okay. Now, again, for the Rambam himself, it's not such a problem, because the Rambam might say that they actually instituted a text and just everyone knew it. That's why they didn't write it down. And that's the impression I get from the Rambam. Everyone knew the text. Anshe Knesset HaGedolah instituted it in order that everyone should be able to have a clean version, a clean text that they davened from. Now, there's a problem in halacha with this Rambam, which is, what's going on here? People don't speak Hebrew well. So therefore, right, we can't allow the free version of tefillah that they used to have. We'll institute a text. I don't understand. Am I allowed to daven in English if I want?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a Mishnah. Eilu ne'amarim b'chol lashon. What? Well, the Gemara says that, right, you can daven in any language. The Gemara says you can daven, the Mishnah and Sota says I can daven in any language. So now, I don't understand. Why is the Rambam making such a big deal to say, oh, the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah instituted the prayer in order that everyone should have a clean text? What difference does it make? Say it in English, right? Now again, maybe he had like Rav Huttner type guys who didn't speak any language well, but you get an impression that the people were a little more sophisticated. What's interesting is this does get a point of what Sam Sofer makes in the Tshuva, which is that even though it's permitted to daven in English, don't do it.
What do you mean? Don't do it, or it's not preferable?
Don't do it. Again, in Shulchan Aruch there's a discussion, maybe as an individual, I should not daven in English, but Betzibur I can. One second, Lottie. There's the Chassam Sofer, however, writes that you're allowed to daven in a foreign language on an occasional basis, but not as a permanent right. You can't put out an English language sitter, says the Chassam Sofer. It's been done, but the Chassam Sofer again is opposing the Reform who are changing the language of prayer. Right? They also, the earliest innovation is that the sermon was in the vernacular.
Yeah.
Of course. But the fact is, the Chassam Sofer has an earlier precedent in this Rambam who says that precisely because we want Hebrew, that's why Anshe Knesset HaGedolah instituted davening. We want them to daven in Hebrew. They could have davened in English, perhaps. Right? But, Lottie.
Yes, very important. We have Aramaic.
Right, so we do say some prayers. We say some prayers in Aramaic. The prayers that we say in Aramaic are only said with a minyan. Any prayer that's in Aramaic, you cannot say it as an individual. You can only say it with a minyan. The Gemara has like a funny expression that the angels don't what? The Aramaic parts of Bevelet Zion you should probably not say. As an individual, I think that's what the post can say. Anything in Aramaic, we don't say biyachid. Yeah,
Kaddish,
we don't say biyachid.
What's
right?
What's that anyway?
Huh?
What is that all about?
The angels. This is a difficult Gemara. The Gemara Shabbos says in one place that the angels don't speak Aramaic, and therefore I should not daven in Aramaic. But Bitzibur, when I am with a group, then I'm not. I don't need the angels to daven because God is there himself, as it were, and I'm davening directly to God. Theologically, this Gemara is extremely problematic. It goes against one of the Rambam's fundamentals of faith, that we don't daven to angels, ever. How we deal with that Gemara is very difficult. I don't have a satisfactory answer. But what we are at now is the question of how did we get the different nuschaos of tefillah. So I have three sources for what I'm going to speak about for the next 5 to 10 minutes, and they are as follows. In 2000, I took a class in the Bernard Revel Graduate School called The History of Prayer with Professor Joseph Tabori. So a lot of what I'm saying is from my notes in his class. There is also, this is probably the best work on the history of the Siddur. It's when the Siddur Rinat Yisrael came out. So Rinat Yisrael is like an Israeli modern Siddur. So Shlomo Tal was the editor of the Rinat Yisrael. He wrote an introduction to the Rinat Yisrael, which is not printed in the Siddurim. It's a separate volume right here, called HaSiddur B'Hishtar Shaluto. The Siddur with its progression, its evolution, its... What?
It's too bad it's not printed with the Siddur.
It's a great, great, great introduction. So this is a very fine work on it. And then this journal called Dialogue in the fall of 2013 has an article by Rabbi Aaron Lopiansky, who's a Rosh Hashiva in Silver Spring.
That's what's named it's expanded.
It's back. Yeah. So Rabbi Lopiansky, actually he spoke in our show last year one time or a year and a half ago. He has a decent article. It's not great. He actually misquotes a few things, in my opinion. But he also goes through the history of the different siddurim. There was no siddur in Judaism until what year? What's the earliest siddur? Who wants to guess? 1000s. 1000s? Reb Sadia Gaon is like number 3 that I know of. But you're close. What? Reb Sadia Gaon lived 882 to 942. Reb Amram Gon is Siddur number 2.
Number 2.
Reb Amram Gon lived, or I don't know when he lived exactly, but he served as Gon, as the head of the yeshiva, from 858 until 870. The earliest Siddur is the Siddur of Reb Natrunai Gon, 853 to 858. Now, Reb Natrunai Gon is not really a Siddur. Reb Natrunai Gon, they call it a Siddur. Basically, it was a question. There are tshuvos of Gaonim that people ask. The Gaonim were the head of the yeshivos, and people ask them, the Trunai Gaon, explain to me what are the 100 brachos that you're supposed to say. The Gemara in Menachos says you're supposed to say Ma Hashem Elokecha Doresh Mimach, the Al Tikrei Ma Elameya, make 100 brachos every day. What are these 100 brachos? So the Trunai Gaon goes through what these 100 brachos are. This is the earliest Siddur. Now, by Siddur, I mean organized prayers. This is the earliest one. After Reb Natrunai Gon, the next Siddur, the Siddur of Reb Amram Gon, 858 to 870, Reb Amram Gon's Siddur is more interesting because Reb Amram Gon was asked a question from the Jews in the brand new Jewish community of Spain. There was no Jewish community in Spain that we know of until this Shaila to Reb Amram Gon. And they ask him, they say, we have a new community. How should we go about davening? So everyone says, oh, that's easy. I'll write out all of the prayers for you. And that is what's called the Siddur of Reb Amram Gon. Now, the problem with the Siddur of Reb Amram Gon is it was too good. And everyone wanted it. And there are multiple copies. But you know what people did when they had the Siddur of Reb Amram Gon? They would take the Siddur and they'd put it down in the Chazan Shtender, and the Chazan would cross out and he'd say, oh, you know, in Frankfurt am Main, we say Pal Reis, not Ha Pal Reis. In Frankfurt am Main, we say...
What?
Right. V'yismuchu v'cha Yisrael al Haveshmecha. Right? And all those things are written on the bottom that, like, additions. what happens sometimes is like a cheirem that began later in Judaism with Rabbeinu Tam, not to correct the text of books, but no one listened to that cheirem, and they would correct the text of books. So we have lots of sidurim of Rabbi Amram Gon out there, and we have no idea what's the real nusach of Rabbi Amram Gon. Because different communities got the text, and they're like, oh, Mirzach nish das, right? They changed it. Now, you think it's only the Siddur of Reb Amram Gon? The Siddur of Reb Sadia Gon had the same thing. The difference is that the Siddur of Reb Sadia Gon was not readily available between the 15th century and the 19th century. So there are less changes in the Siddur of Reb Sadia than the Siddur of Reb Amram. Reb Sadia's Siddur also is more of a traditional Siddur in the sense of it has explanations and halachic guidance for how to properly daven. Reb Amram is more just a text. Reb Amram is a response to a question. Reb Sadia wrote a Siddur. He sat down, took out a pen, and said, this is how you daven.
Kavanas?
What? No kavanah is the way you're thinking, but this is how you should say it, etc. These are the texts that Reb Sadia has. Now, I should point out that recently, by recently I mean from the days of Solomon Schechter onwards, we have access to other sidurim. All the sidurim that we have, Reb Nachshonai, Reb Amram, Reb Sadia, the three earliest sidurim are the Babylonian rite, the Siddur Minhag Bavel. But everyone knows that there were two Minhagim. There's Minhag Bavel, Minhag Eretz Yisrael. Minhag Eretz Yisrael existed in not that many places, but there was one part of Cairo called Fustat that had Minhag Eretz Yisrael, and in Fustat they also found what they call the Cairo Geniza. And in the Cairo Geniza I have texts of the original Minhag Eretz Yisrael. Minhag Eretz Yisrael does not exist anywhere in the world in a pure form. Well, the way they daven in the Cairo Geniza, no one davens that way. However, by and large, Sephardi Jews daven closer to Minhag Bavel because the letter of Rabbi Amram going to Sfarad, right, is Bavel to Spain, direct. The Jews in Italy, which was closer to Eretz Israel, the Machzor Roma, and there was one Machzor before the Machzor Roma that was burned in a fire in 1894 in Turin, in Italy. In that fire, there was a Sefer called the Sefer Chibur Brachos, which is probably the closest we have to Minhag Eretz Israel. And that Sefer Chibur Brachos was burned, so we don't have the complete book. We have some versions of it. What we know about Minhag Eretz Yisrael is that it continued on Yomim Tovim to a large extent in different communities. For example, we know we have lots of Gaonic works that go through some of the differences between Minhag Bavel and Minhag Eretz Yisrael. We have some Gaonic works that do that. Now, part of these works outline all the differences. And some of the differences include, do you sit for Shema or stand for Shema? Okay, those are differences. Other differences are that in Minhag Eretz Yisrael, they would not finish the bracha HaMachzir Shkinoso L'Tzion. They'd finish the bracha She'oscho Levadcha Be'yira Na'avod. That's the way it's done on Yontif when we duchen. Right? Now that makes perfect sense because when you're duchening, you are bringing back vestiges. This is a point that Shaul Lieberman makes and others make also. You're bringing back vestiges of the Minhag Eretz Yisrael. There are lots of these differences that are brought out. And if I find my notes, I'd remember what else I wanted to say. And these are some of the... These are some of the issues. So basically, the history of the Siddur that we have it, right? The earliest real Siddur is Reb Amram Gon, but we just don't know what's there. We don't know exactly what's in Nusach, and different communities davened different ways. That's ultimately the story of Judaism in Gaulis. The questions that come up is, now that we are we have access to Eretz Yisrael, do we change the liturgy? Nachem was a huge fight. Did we change the liturgy? Rav Goren tried to put out a Nusach Achid that was a colossal failure. Do we say V'tolichenu mehera komamiyut be'artzeinu instead of komamiyut le'artzeinu, because we're in Eretz Yisrael? No one makes these changes. In part because there is a very strong resistance to change, which is the conversation that we began with today. Yeah, Lottie?
What's Sefer Victory?
Machzor Victory. So Machzor Victory is a Machzor that comes from the Beis Medrash of Rashi. Now, I should point out that the word Machzor, the way we use it, means for Yontiv, and Siddur means for every day. Machzor Victory was used all year long. Right? It's called Machzor because it would do the Machzor Hashanah. The entire year was in the Machzor Victory. The students of Rashi had Machzor Victory. Machzor Victory is based on the groundwork of Siddur Rebbe Amram Gon. It adds its own halachic explanations based on Minhagim in Spire. That's where Machzor Victory is coming from. That's the basic story of how the various Nuscha'os came about. No one can tell you what the original Nusach was. In fact, there's a machlokas among the scholars whether there was an original Nusach at all. And that's sort of what we began with. When Anshei Knesset HaGadol instituted Tefillah, did they institute a specific Nusach HaTefillah? I think it's more likely that they didn't institute a specific Nusach HaTefillah, but they instituted rules of davening. If that's the case, no one could find the original Siddur. It's not going to exist. It's not going to exist. And when we dive in, so it's based on these ideas. And okay, I thank you for listening.